Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On David Pressler, toy maker and puppet maker. For more information about the news and links we talk about in the show, go to our website at www.geekson.com. Welcome, everybody.
To Geeks On.
New Geeks On again.
Another one.
We're almost back on our regular schedule.
Like that. Ba-bam, ba-bam.
Yes. Well, we had to get two out before Comic-Con because we talk about Comic-Con.
That's true.
I'm sorry I'm late. I was completely distracted by my Harry Potter 7 book.
It's fine, Matt. We don't mind waiting here for you while you read Harry Potter.
So you were half an hour.
You had it delivered this morning.
I had it delivered this morning by Amazon.com. And I opened the door in my boxers, and there's a guy in a robe.
So it's basically your normal Saturday morning.
Yeah. You know.
I don't get
like
this.
That.
So Amazon is hand-delivering Harry Potter books by
robed
wizards.
Message carriers. I don't know whether or not it was just... I don't know whether or not it was just him or whether or not it was...
I'm just shocked
what they're doing.
That there's that much book delivery that they can send a separate guy just for the book.
I don't know. He had a big stack of them in his hand. I don't know whether or not my apartment building is Harry Potter-centric, but...
That's crazy.
Yeah. It's great. It's great publicity for whatever service.
Yeah, because Harry Potter's in desperate need of publicity.
Yeah, right, you know, nobody... Let me finish what I just said. It's great publicity for whatever service is delivering the books. Not only that, I actually didn't bring it, but what I thought was interesting was that I got the special edition, and enclosed, this is the outer cover of it with the lovely stars and art by Marie Grandpré, who actually also illustrated my dad's children's book. So we could get Marie Grandpré if we're interested. And here is the collector's edition of Harry Potter Book 7.
Ah!
Yeah.
Oh, sorry about that.
You already did that once. Yeah.
This is the bad guy here?
This is the episode where Peter destroys a grown man's studio.
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous book. And it's
so your
really
geek
well done.
Week is starting.
My geek week is awesome. I'm reading A Hatful of Sky on Don's recommendation by Terry Pratchett as well. And I had to pause A Hatful of Sky to start Harry Potter because it's necessary.
Yeah.
Come on.
It's near though.
It's book 7. And I have to know. And that's been awesome. I've just been reading and I've been reading Hidden Passages, which is an amazing book on physics. And if anybody wants to explain, I don't know, chapter 3 to me in detail, it would be a big help.
How long before we do our Harry Potter episode? I mean, how long do we let people know that we're going to be Harry Potter spoiler free?
6 months.
6 months?
It's a book, so we got to give them at least 6 months, I think.
Well, I'm wondering how many people out there was just like, I'll wait until she finishes the series before I start.
Right.
I would say 3 months.
Three months?
Listen.
3 months? You know what, if you're a huge fan and you haven't read the final book within 3 months, I think maybe...
Well, I'm a cheap-ass bastard waiting for someone I know who bought the book to finish it so I can borrow it.
Oh, okay.
I'll tell you what. Here's what we should. We should all finish it. We can just make it a spoiler episode. People know they don't want to listen to it if they have the books, if they haven't read it. And that's it, you know? I mean, that's a great thing about a podcast.
We will eventually be talking about how Harry Potter... spoiler-free episode.
Shh, 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 shh. Don't say it.
Did any of you actually read the spoilers online?
No.
No.
Are there?
No.
Yeah, the ending got leaked about a week before
the book
came out.
A guy took photos of all the parts that were spoilers in the book.
What a dick!
Now, here's the funny thing is he took the pictures with a digital camera.
Uh-huh.
He did not realize that there is metadata embedded in digital cameras.
Right.
I tell you, it records the serial number of your camera.
Dope.
So if he has registered this camera, or if he's brought it in for repair or anything like that,
screwed.
He's got a lawsuit on his hands.
I would throw that sucker out so quick.
Oh, so would I.
Yeah, it was stolen. Yeah.
Yeah.
That camera would be at the bottom of a lake right now.
Yeah. Geek police showing up on his doorstep real quick, beating the cops by a full half hour.
In robes with extra long wands.
Yeah.
With little taser tips.
Snape would like to have a word with you.
Yeah. Alan Rickman in front, just looking menacing. Also saw the movie, the Harry Potter movie.
I did too.
I thought it was the best Harry Potter movie to
really?
Date.
I still like
I'm
three
with
better.
Aaron on this one, and we really? Never agree. We never agree on movies.
I really liked it a lot.
It was...
I do agree it was the best one.
Like, I haven't read the books, so these movies have just been kind of all the same to me. Mm-hmm. Like, and they also usually have some type of random weird thing that doesn't have anything to do with the main plot line. Like, we're going to have a competition.
Right.
I'm like, okay, so this is the one with the competition. This is the one with the dogs with three heads. This is the one, like, you know. But this last movie was all about the main plot line. The whole movie was right. about the huge mythos and about the characters, not about random keys floating in the air. And
well, I also, having read the books, mm-hmm. my take on it was that it covered less of the book
yes.
than probably any of the movies from before it.
Oh, really?
But felt like more of a movie than any of the movies.
Okay, I can see that. I still prefer... You
know, it felt more complete to me.
I prefer movie number 3, the Cuarón film, because I believe it had more style than any of the rest of them, and I feel like...
Which one was that?
It was the one where Sirius almost gets eaten by the Death Eaters.
Okay.
That's one where someone becomes like a
it's
rat.
The introduction, yes. It's the introduction of the Gary Oldman character.
That and, was the last movie.
No, that was number movies. 3. 2 movies ago.
That did confuse me because...
What was the last
since
movie?
That's the last movie they had to do this competition. They're
yeah.
swimming in the
oh,
water.
Oh, yeah. Okay, duh. Yeah.
I was a little confused with this movie because, since I hadn't read the books, like... Suddenly, you know, Gary Oldman is...
Spoiler alert?
I guess. Okay. Spoiler alert. Since Gary Oldman started, like, you know, hugging Harry Potter at the beginning of the movie, he's like, oh, Harry! I'm like, I thought... Since when are you guys related?
Hmm.
I just didn't remember that.
Yeah, okay.
I mean...
Well that's in the movie.
We'll do a big movie marathon one day.
We'll save this for our Harry Potter episode.
Okay. Yes.
I also saw The Transformers.
What'd you think? I still haven't seen it. Other than I really want to see Megan Fox in anything.
I'm completely lukewarm on it, and...
I thought it was fun.
It's not a great movie.
Okay. No, but it's fun.
But it is a ton of fun, and I actually did have a little emotional nostalgia kind of well up in me at Optimus Prime having his voice. Even though some of his dialogue is totally cheesy and kind of like speechy, I was just like...
Roll out.
Sort of.
Yeah, totally. It's
the dialogue's terrible in the movie.
Yeah. But the dialogue was not necessarily brilliant in the cartoon either. Yeah. So it's like...
But here's one tip I would give to people watching the movie for the first time. Do your best to forget plot points as soon as they come up, because they are so badly constructed and the plot holes are so incredibly large.
Yeah.
Part of my problem with the movie is I felt really insulted by it. You know, because some of the plot points that are supposed to tie everything up mm-hmm. make no sense. I mean, it's not like they're just missing a few things.
Wow.
They actively don't make sense.
I think we could do a whole Transformers episode, to be honest.
I think we should. Yeah, we'll wait maybe. Maybe you can do it the next time.
Have you guys seen the YouTube... have you seen the cartoon movie?
Yes.
In the cartoon movie, spoiler alert, 20 years ago, Optimus Prime dies. He's
right.
killed.
With Bumblebee and Ratchet.
Yeah. Exactly. And there's this YouTube thing where in the TV show, they actually ended up bringing Optimus Prime back to life. And he retakes control of the Autobots. And in this YouTube episode, they show him coming back to life, and he's like, all right, Ratchet, come on. And Optimus, Ratchet's dead. And he's like, all right, Bumblebee. Sorry, sir. Bumblebee's dead, too. And they just him with absolutely no knowledge of what's gone on over the last 6 years and finding out everybody that he knows is dead. It's the most depressing. And they edited it really well. So it's just Optimus getting more and more progressively depressed until he walks into his room and shuts the door.
I haven't seen that.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, we should do it. We'll do a Transformers episode.
Excellent.
Everyone's seen it.
See who we can get.
I thought Live Free or Die Harder was a better movie, though.
I haven't seen that.
The Terminator movie?
Yeah.
Terminator
Die
4?
Die Hard.
No, it's Terminator
4.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I have not seen it.
Yeah, Die Hard is Terminator 4.
It's Terminator 4. Wait until you see the Chinese chick go through 8 walls and then, I mean...
Get hit by 60 miles per hour.
I'm not exaggerating.
Oh, God.
I'm not exaggerating. Chick fight, and that's the last moment in the film that bears any semblance to movie reality, even.
Yeah.
Okay. Then he drives a car through a wall, hits her with a Chevy F-150 or Ford F-150.
50 or 60 miles per hour.
50 or 60 miles per hour. Drives her through seven or eight other walls in through an elevator shaft. The truck falls down it. They hang from the wires, and then they begin a martial arts fight.
It's like she doesn't even blink after that. She's ready to
rock.
Wow.
She's my new hero.
She actually will be. She's gorgeous. And
everybody's
guys,
like that. John McClane is a Terminator. Everyone's a Terminator in the movie.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's like a whole bunch of Terminators. Okay. That's taken over the bodies of our heroes from Die Hard.
Yeah, and the Mac guy is actually C-3PO. Yeah. Sorry, Peter, you were going to say something?
No, I wouldn't say a thing.
I released my latest video game yesterday.
Cool.
Fever Frenzy.
Fever
Excellent.
Frenzy. Yeah.
Is that why you look fevered and frenzied?
Oh, my God. for those of you who want to go into video game, the glamorous and glitzy world of video game production, it can be fun. It can be a lot of quite an adventure, but I guarantee you the last 1 week of any project you work on will be a living hell. I mean, you have to understand it's worse than any other industry as far as that last moment of agony trying to get anything out the door.
Yeah.
Just because the deadlines are so hard and you're working so much right up until the very last instant. I mean, literally the last instant before someone invests in your project.
Right.
So.
Icky.
Crazy. And before we move on to news, I want to remind everybody that we will be at Comic-Con.
Woohoo!
And we will be meeting people. We're all going to get together, have drinks, at least us. I don't know if anybody else will show up, but we're going to go out and have drinks on Saturday evening at 8 o'clock.
And again, my invitation stands on the forums for anybody who can come up with a drink called the Geek or the Geekling. That's actually good. I'll drink it.
That you can order at the bar.
I'll drink it.
I have a little piece of geek news that's separate from Comic-Con.
All right. Well, just I just want to say you can find out where we're meeting by going to our website, www.geekson.com. And Peter is going to post all that information on the front page this week, like very soon. And
do it now, Peter.
So that everyone will know where to meet us. It's going to be 8 o'clock on Saturday. At
the Yard House.
The Yard House. Okay. Groovy.
Slightly related to Comic-Con, but a little different. The webisode that I've been working on.
Oh, yes.
Trenches.
Trenches.
It's now posted up at trenchesonline.com.
I saw. It's a great trailer.
You can see the trailer. Cool. You can see some photos of it. And on top of that, actually, Shane is going to be at Comic-Con, and he's going to be showing the trailer. I don't know what booth he's at, unfortunately.
Okay.
But I do know he's going to be there, so keep your eyes peeled for him. And
I'm also going to be in a panel on Saturday at 12:30. We'll post that, too. It's
really?
I'm helping talking.
But that's right. That was in your This is what Aaron's doing over Comic-Con.
Yeah. I'm one of our listeners, who Scott Russell, he's got a short film, and he is going to show it at Comic-Con, and he's going to talk about it, and he invited me to sit up there with him and talk about short filmmaking and low-budget filmmaking as well. So we'll be up there. I'm his guest. We'll post information where that is in case you want to see us talk about short films.
And like I think I may have gotten us a big interview for Comic-Con, but I don't know yet.
We're not unveiling it
We're
yet.
Not unveiling
it. Yeah.
I think.
It's becoming sort of a yearly tradition, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Matt's pretty good at that. He's been working his butt off.
Orson Scott Card 2 years ago? No. Yeah, 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
George R. R. Martin last year, and then I think I can beat them both this year.
Really?
Who knows? We'll see.
Well, go Matt.
We'll see.
Matt's a rock star.
So on a side note, we have a new wonderful award for Peter. As the first of us to complete the Oblivion game.
Yeah, we talked about it last week.
On the last show. On the show, you were in absentia.
But I have a new moral quandary with Oblivion, which is I've kind of finished all the mainstream quests. You know, I'm head of the Fighters Guild. I'm close to head of the Mages Guild. I'm head of the Thieves Guild. So now there's a couple extra things I can do, but morally I'm ambivalent. You know, there's the Assassin's Quests.
Yeah,
and they're dark and evil.
Peter, you can download Shivering Isles, which is another 30 hours, and there's three other downloads, Knights of the Nine and Pirates Pirate's Quest or something, which are like 6 or 7 hours each.
Maybe I'll download
your them. Quest has only begun, my
it's
friend.
Only begun. But no, but there is the question: should I do that? And then there's also the Daedric items quest. And there's
oh, I did a few of those. Oh my goodness, do you get good stuff?
You get great. Well, I've done almost all of them at this point. But there's two more left that are really dark. You have to do some crappy things.
I had to start over. Yeah.
So, but
here, I had to too.
If you do.
Now that Peter has his 360 back, you know I have to. Yeah.
If you do all the Daedric item quests, there's one special quest that you can do that is like the king of... You have to do all the Daedric item quests so you can do this last one. And it apparently gives you something really kind of awesome and cool. So,
which you'll need for what, since you'd pretty much finished the game by then?
Well, you just told me I can download like another 40 hours of content. I mean, come on.
Peter can be truly uber. He will be awesome beyond your wildest imaginations.
But this is my moral, you know, my moral conundrum is, should I do all the evil stuff just so I can see what the storyline is?
Well,
Start a dark side path. Character.
Well, I was considering doing an assassin's character, right? And so... I was in this city, and I don't know which one, and there's a guy who's insane, and he's basically dealing with a bunch of... He's paranoid, and he thinks there's a bunch of people coming after him. And according to the internet, that is the best quest to begin your road down the assassination path, because by killing him as a part of its quest, you don't gain any evil points to begin the assassin's quest. And then the assassin's quest, most of them are stealthy.
Are there evil points?
Yeah, yes. There are. You can also get...
I didn't know that.
Yes.
What does that do to you?
Gradually, people will not let you into cities. You know, you become unaccepted. Oh. You know.
I've been a shining paragon of virtue.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. Me too. But you can
besides
also,
that whole vampire thing that plagued me for hours.
Aaron had a little disease.
Yeah, for like a long fucking time.
Is vampirism a social disease?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Trust me.
Because the longer you go without drinking blood, the more you look like a monster. You get
and they will not. They will not. People won't talk to you. People will not do anything. It's a big pain in the ass.
So, I mean, it's pretty impressive. We're, what, a year and a half after its release?
And it's still talking about it?
It's a good game. You know? I mean, keeps your attention. Mm-hmm. It's easy to put down and pick back up later if you want to start other games. It's
start not back up.
So I never want to do alchemy again. I'm so done gathering herbs. Moving on.
All right. So now let's do the news.
All right. Who's hitting it?
I'll do one.
Peter.
So the state of Georgia has just granted Range Fuels a permit to create the first cellulosic ethanol plant in America.
Wow. That's the next step?
Yeah, apparently this is the next step. I mean, I don't know if it's entirely working the way it should, but if it does, it sounds really neat.
I know this because I just auditioned for a Jimmy Smith pilot, and I had to say, cellulosic ethanol, that's the next step. That's one of my lines.
Is that your Asian scientist?
That was my. It was literally an Asian scientist. Cellulosic ethanol. That's the next step.
Well, here's the deal. Cellulosic ethanol is ethanol that comes from cellulose instead of sugar. This is good because most plants don't have a lot of sugar, but all plants have lots of cellulose. So instead of using food crops like corn or sugarcane, which are high sugar content crops to create fuel, you can use any crops like mown grass clippings, fallen tree limbs, corn stalks instead of the ears, to create ethanol.
It's like Mr. Fusion.
It's totally Mr. Fusion.
The unfortunate thing is it's more difficult to create ethanol from cellulose. But if we get there, basically here's some of the numbers. Cellulosic ethanol can contain up to 16 times more energy than is required to create it. If that doesn't sound impressive, consider that gasoline is only 5 times more energy than was required to create it. Corn ethanol, which is what we're trying – is what they're pushing in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
For what reason, I have no idea, because
right.
It's so lame.
Lobbyists.
Only contains 1.3 times the energy.
What?
To create it.
Yeah.
1.3.
As opposed to sugarcane, which is like 3, isn't it?
It's something like that.
I thought it was a 3-1.
That's insanity. Yeah. I didn't know it was that.
Oh, yeah. It's completely lame. I mean, why? I don't even know why we would be doing
it. Lobbyists. Corn lobbyists.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
I mean...
A lot of the Midwest states depend on that.
It's the reason why we get corn syrup.
Well, tell them to grow sugar instead. I mean, come on.
Yeah,
it's hard to,
damn.
Sugar doesn't just grow anywhere.
Stupid. Yeah, you know. It's hard to grow sugar in the middle of farmers.
I know.
Keeping me alive with my indulgency.
All right, so we have a super, we have Mr. Fusion on the way. That's awesome.
I think it's neat if it eventually comes. But basically, I mean, you know, wood chips contain a lot of energy. You know, I mean, that's why we burn them. Fire.
Yeah.
You know, so if they can turn that energy into something we can drive a car with, that's awesome.
Wow. That's impressive. So, in other news, like also another movie, The Terminator is on its way. Taser and iRobot have announced an alliance to build a robot that comes equipped with a taser. The companies plan to sell the robot for use in prisons or combat. Heard this interview with a guy from globalsecurity.net on Marketplace on NPR, and it was frightening because they're literally trying to create robots that are stronger, bigger, with tasers to subdue prison populations without injury to humans.
Drop it or there will be trouble.
Yeah, that's basically, yeah, it's going to be...
So, RoboCop.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and basically, where were they? They're going to be teleoperating a lot of the early models right now, but basically they're saying that here's his quote, "The big development that you're looking for over the next 5 to 15 years is increasing degrees of autonomy, that you can give the robot mission orders, apprehend everybody who's in the building, and the robot would follow through with all of the rest. That's what the big development's going to be. That's where you're going to see sudden advances. That's where the unfolding of Moore's Law, the doubling of computer power every 18 months, that's what you're starting to get into the feel of RoboCop or Terminator.
Hmm.
Not in the next 5 years, but look 10 years down the road, and that's what you're going to start to look at. At that point, there are all kind of applications that people are going to be interested in.
Who are these guys who keep saying in 15 years we're going to have flying cars and robots? Haven't we learned our lesson, like, in the 50s? Haven't we learned our lesson not to project 15 years?
Well, Moore's Law has held true, but
with computing power,
right.
Not with flying cars and robots.
Well, the problem with robots is that it's mechanical representations of movement.
Yeah, so stop playing 15 years from now.
Right.
Well, I disagree. Robots are in place now, just not in the places we thought they'd be.
Right.
You know, go to your average automotive manufacturing.
I'm just saying,
plant.
If you're a futurist, stop saying in 15 years we're going to have guys walking around, robot cops walking around, because it ain't going to happen.
I don't think they're supposed to be walking around, but they might be rolling around.
Sounds like a challenge, scientists. Sounds like a challenge.
Aaron has challenged you.
The gauntlet has been thrown down.
It's like, you know, it's like those stupid futurists 30 years ago who said, you know, we're going
to
have...
30 years ago, they didn't have the... I mean, it's taken a long while to get to the computer power that
whatever,
we are.
Please.
All right.
Come on, people.
I brought a news story in about the new Green Hornet movie is apparently on the tracks now with Mr. Seth Rogen starring as the Green Hornet.
Seth Rogen.
Doughy star of this summer's breakout hit Knocked Up is finalizing a deal to write and likely star in Columbia's big screen adaptation of the Green Hornet.
Strange.
They want it to be a comedy.
Yeah.
I've already...
Really?
Talked to a guy, yeah. It's going to be funny. Yeah. That's what they
want. If Will Yun Lee gets the damn part, I'm going to cry.
I'm just going to send a quick shout out to those producers to let them know we have a much better script here that Aaron has written.
He has my script.
Oh, okay.
The guy who's making that movie has my script.
You got a better script in hand. Just saying. Just saying.
Yeah. Anyways,
that's all. So
don't
Seth
get
Rogen,
me started.
Seth Rogen's starting work on his new superhero movie, The Green Hornet. Though I mean, on one side, even if it is a comedy, I would personally love to see, you know, just a bigger action star, just once, you know, just once. Just saying. Power to the fat.
Do not get me started.
All right,
I've moved on. I've got a different script.
He's making his own film, ladies and gentlemen. Aaron, hit it.
But he's not bitter.
All right, let's start, since we're in the television film media. Just want to congratulate Heroes, the television series, for walking away with a whole bunch of Emmy nominations.
What? Really?
Oh, yeah. Lots. Best drama series.
God, please.
Wait, isn't it in the like same category as The Sopranos?
Let me list the other ones. Boston Legal, Grey's Anatomy, Heroes, House, and The Sopranos.
Okay, this is...
One of these things is not like the other.
Come on. This is basically... Reality has taken 60% of the market in Los Angeles, and we are just, like, dredging. Come on.
Yeah, but I don't know.
They couldn't put Battlestar?
Battlestar Galactica.
They couldn't put Battlestar?
Dexter?
No.
Dexter would have been a great suggestion.
I mean,
Dexter doesn't have a big enough cast, but still.
Rome.
For best drama series?
Wasn't Rome part of the last season? You know?
I don't know.
I mean, you don't have to have a big cast to have a best drama series. Okay, so best supporting actor? The guy, Masioka.
I would support that.
Okay, good.
He carries the series. I support it.
But just because he carries the series doesn't mean he's one of the best actors out there in television.
Have you seen the rest of that series? If you're still tuning in because of one person, he deserves a best actor nod.
All right.
Well,
all right.
I hope he gets it because it will help Asian actors everywhere.
William Shatner's on the list for his portrayal in Boston Legal.
I watch Boston Legal and he does a superior job.
He's consistently good.
He's unbelievably good.
Although I love the fact that, you know, as Captain Kirk, he was awarded for, playing an arrogant young Turk. And now he's being awarded for playing a...
arrogant old prick?
Arrogant old prick who's drunk. You know, it's like,
I think we found his.
Who else?
We have T.R. Knight as George in Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, he's okay.
And Michael Emerson as Ben in Lost. And Terry O'Quinn as Locke. By the way,
I would appreciate Terry O'Quinn. I think Terry O'Quinn does a marvelous job as Locke.
Actually, I think the guy who plays Ben does a pretty good job. But I don't know about best. I don't know. Ben is the bad guy.
Okay.
I saw him at Farmer's Market the other day. Directing.
It's hard to be that guy.
The Kaiser shows
it. People are freaking attacking him all the time, going, yo!
I don't know. Everyone left him alone there.
That's because they're afraid of him.
Directing for a drama.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, we have a guy from Battlestar who directed. His name is Felix Ocala.
Okay.
Ocala.
O-C-A-L-A?
A-L-C-A-L-A.
Oh, I haven't watched it.
He directed Exodus Part 2, which is nominated.
Oh, really? Good episode.
Good episode.
A Boston Legal episode, a Friday Night Lights episode, or the pilot.
Wow.
And then, of course, Heroes, one of the episodes there. Through the Looking Glass from Lost.
Wow.
And an episode of the pilot of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip was also.
That was another great series that could have been nominated. Yeah.
So anyway, those three categories, Heroes has got nominations for.
Yeah. Wow.
A lot of the internet sites, the internet sites are definitely calling bullshit on the fact that Battlestar Galactica really got no nominations.
Yeah seriously.
You know, come on.
You know, it's anti-sci-fi bias. It's all it is. You know,
but
the screeners of the Academy weren't willing to watch it.
Well, what it is that certain channels get respect mm-hmm. and other channels don't. Sci-Fi Channel, most of their stuff is crap.
If they stop doing things like Mankiddo,
then maybe people. No.
We have a new one.
Or Species 3.
No, put aside Mankiddo. We have Super Gator.
Super Gator?
Super Gator.
Super Gator.
Okay, if I can't sell my film to Sci-Fi Channel...
I think you need to go into your bedroom and just hide under the covers.
Yeah, there's some serious problems.
Super Gator, man.
All right, Peter.
Okay, so my new story... I think I've actually covered this story once before, but I just love the story so much I wanted to cover it again.
Not the fucking iPhone again.
Yeah, no. This is all about cardiac arrest and how people die.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There was an article about this in Time.
Yeah. And how our view of how to treat people when their heart stops is totally changing.
Oh, yes. Right. Yes.
So basically, here's the deal. About 250,000 times a year in the United States, someone's heart stops for some reason.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they stop breathing.
And there's the 5-minute window.
And there's the there's the 5-minute window. But basically, you know, you have about a 95% chance of dying.
Mm-hmm.
If you know, because you know, you're not going to have the ambulance get there in time most times.
Right.
You know, it takes about 10 minutes for people to get to you normally, on average. So they've been looking at this rule, and they've noticed that the rule is not an absolute rule. We've known for a long time this 5-minute window. You know, it's different under certain circumstances, and that circumstance is, you know, we've seen people fall into a lake and be under there for like 15 minutes and come out and be fine. If it's an icy lake,
mm-hmm.
okay. Even Napoleon noticed that in his Russian campaign, His surgeon general told him that the wounded infantrymen left on the snowy ground to recover had a much better survival rate than officers who stayed warm near the campfires.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Which sucks because his infantry were surviving and his officers weren't.
Right. So what happens most of the time, they say half the time in cardiac arrest, they get the heart going, blood pressure's good, everything is going along, and then suddenly, within a few hours, everything crashes and the patient is dead. Now,
Beep, beep, beep.
So, now, when they look at cells, what's interesting is it, when you deprive oxygen from cells, for the first 24 hours after you deprive the oxygen, mm-hmm. the cells look absolutely normal.
Mm-hmm.
It's only 24 hours later they start to change.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the equivalent of saying, you know, you take the gas from the car stops moving, but the car still works. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the car is still...
Well, something's dying.
Well, well, not yet. That's the point. Something is not dying. At that point.
Well, why does your body stop functioning?
We're getting to that.
Oh. Yeah.
See,
that's the thing, is that this is part of death science, which is this new incredible science, which is basically saying that we die over a very extended period of time.
Hmm, yeah.
That
okay.
is, it's not instantaneous.
So basically what happens is your cells still look normal for that first 24 hours. They don't really have any change. What's actually happened is... Okay, and here's exactly what Matt just said. Cell death isn't an event, it's a process. And in principle, the process can be interrupted. The process appears to begin in the mitochondria, which is the control of the cell's self-destruct mechanism, known as apoptosis. Apoptosis is the self-destruct mechanism. And a related process, necrosis. Basically, what apoptosis is, it's a natural function where the body destroys cells it doesn't need anymore,
mm-hmm.
and or cells that have been damaged in some way. Cancer cells are cells where the mitochondria has been destroyed or damaged in some way, so it can't do this process.
Okay.
So cancer researchers are trying to figure out a way to turn the mitochondria back on so it can do this. In our case, we're trying to do the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're trying to find a way where cells that have been injured from lack of oxygen, we're trying to stop them from committing suicide. That's
okay.
absolutely what's happening. Yeah, that's basically what's happening. So what they found out is basically when you put oxygen back into the body,
mm-hmm.
that's what starts the process of suicide. It's that process of giving more fuel back into the body where the cells all go,
yeah.
oh, there's a little damage here, and they all just decide that they're going to
yeah,
kill
so
themselves.
The white blood cells start taking those cells which have been damaged.
So you're
and
saying that the
CPR, stuff like that, that add oxygen back into the body is what begins the process of killing
yeah.
people.
Okay.
So we've actually been killing people with CPR.
Yeah, and the thing that we typically do when we get someone in a hospital is they put a mask on them and just...
pump a full of oxygen.
Pure oxygen into them.
Okay.
Which is the thing that's going to kill them.
Okay.
So what they've been looking at and what they found out is that if you take something like hypothermia and you induce hypothermia in someone that's just had a heart attack,
mm-hmm.
they have a much significant – and you slow down the rate that oxygen comes into them,
mm-hmm.
they have a much significant higher rate of survival.
Yeah. And what's amazing in the cases that they were talking about in Time magazine was that they're injecting this hyper-cooled saline solution into them. It's sort mm-hmm. of like icy slush.
Yeah.
Into their veins. It's like 40 degrees.
Mm.
And these people who are recovering from this have memory loss of about 2 weeks surrounding the event consistently, mm-hmm. but otherwise their brains are fully functional after being dead for hours.
Really?
Oh, almost, okay. yeah. I mean,
see a script.
Yeah, exactly.
Flatliners 2.
Yeah.
So
yeah, Flatliners 2. I think there was a Flatliners 2.
Oh, God, really? Oh, yeah. Lord.
So anyway, but this is fascinating. I mean, what they talk about here is 14 patients that they did this on, 8 of them survived, 6 of them with complete recovery. So that's
yeah.
much higher than 5% rate.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I mean, that's a 50% improvement. I mean, that's not a 50%. Mm. That's like a huge improvement. But
right.
50% survival rate. The problem is that very few hospitals have this technology. They're not picking it up. They're not. Mm. They're not noticing the research and deciding to implement it.
Maybe the Time magazine article will move.
Maybe the
along.
Time magazine article will do it. But anyway, this is just. It's really fascinating because our whole concept about how to treat people and how death works is just.
I'm just reminded of the Star Trek where they go back in time and the woman's like, I have leukemia. And Bones turns towards the camera and he goes, what is this, the Dark Ages? And he gives her 2 pills. He's like, take 2 of these. And then there's a scene where she's coming down the hall going, I'm cured! Yeah. I'm cured! I love that.
I totally don't remember this.
Really?
Oh, it's, yeah, when it's, they have to, they
it's
have
in
to
Save
rescue,
the Whales.
They have
the
to whales. Rescue...
Save the Whales!
A Chekhov, because he falls off the nuclear vessel.
I guess I have to watch this again.
Yeah. The nuclear
it's
vessel.
It's been too
nuclear,
long.
It's hilarious.
Save the Whales!
Okay, gecko glue exploits muscle power. The remarkable adhesive abilities of geckos and mussels have been combined to create a super sticky material. Unlike other adhesives...
Super glue?
It's super sticky. Well, here's the thing. Unlike other adhesives inspired by the nimble reptiles, geckle is what they're calling the glue. Can attach to both wet and dry surfaces, which is really, really interesting.
That's interesting.
Do they understand how it works?
Yeah, its staying power comes from coating fibrous silicone, similar in structure to a gecko's foot, with a polymer that mimics the glue used by mussels. So it's really funky. Writing in Nature, the researchers say it could have medical applications. I envision that adhesive tapes made out of geckle could be used to replace sutures for wound closure and may also be useful as a water-resistant adhesive for bandages and drug delivery patches.
Well, this is awesome because, I mean, you know, it's very hard to close up a bleeding wound.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like... And if you can just smack this on and it'll glue even with the wetness of the blood there, that's pretty darn cool.
And the thing with this is that geckos have this incredible ability to stick to surfaces. They basically can hold hundreds of times their own body weight in adhesion. So,
well, that dude with the hard helmet would put the super glue and attach himself to the girder. You remember that?
That's true.
I mean, that was pretty cool.
That was pretty cool. But it wasn't wet.
True.
It wasn't a wet girder.
Yeah.
True. I'd like to see him try that.
That's in the rain.
40 feet above the ground.
I was going to have us do a mini conversation about Transformers, but we already did it.
Okay. So. Well, I quickly would like to announce that Days of Wonder has on their website some previews of their new expansion packs for Battlelore. Which looked pretty cool. So there's been some, already been some expansions for Battlelore, which is the Memoir 44 version. It's Memoir 44 with elves and
cool,
that type of thing. Peter has the game. I have the game. But they have some extra packs now. They're selling little mini packs with different types of figurines that has different rules. The first one that's coming out is called... these are called Skirmish Packs, by the way. So the first one is called the Goblin Skirmishers and the Dwarven Battalion. So it's a little pack of dwarven armies that you can use, and goblins, and those guys
that's
are the little weaselly
awesome
dudes who run around, and they don't fight well, but there's so many of them, you just kind of hoard your opponent.
That's awesome. You're just hoarding yourself out.
Then, yes, they're little hordes. The Dwarven Battalion packs, the Battalion Specialist pack is coming, that have 8 spear bearers, 6 axe swingers, 4 iron dwarf bagpipers.
Who wants to be a spear bearer? Here, hold my spear. Bearer.
Goblin marauders. And then also the Hundred Years' War, which is a little more historically accurate.
Oh, that's great.
And less fantasy version.
That's interesting.
Yeah. The cool thing about the game is they have historical scenarios, and then they have fantasy scenarios. You can decide whether you want to play a more realistic game or...
Could I have my fantasy elves beat up your World War II soldiers?
fantasy elves would get massacred.
That you cannot mix the games, mainly...
They're all Legolas.
That's true.
The scale is different.
They're shorter?
Yeah.
Don's
so anyway,
the best look.
Who let you in?
I know.
Each one of these packs comes with some playing cards, which gives you the new rules of the new weapons and troop units, and I think some new terrain rules and
Excellent.
Stuff like that.
Also, in final news, I am going to be one of the lead voices on Age of Empires 3, the expansion pack.
Yay!
See.
Nice.
Listen, I will be me. Being a big old Asian warlord. There we are.
Can
Go
you
ahead.
Can you do an Asian accent?
No, I'm not going to do it now.
Okay.
No,
you sure?
That's reserved for me and my fiance.
Ew.
Me love you
Ew.
Long time.
Me so horny.
All right.
Moving on. Let's hit our interview.
Our interview. Awesome.
We interviewed someone?
Yes, we did.
Ooh.
The lake.
Casino.
Ladies and gentlemen, geeks and geekettes, Dave Pressler! Character designer, animator, and sculptor here on Geeks On.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to... Well, I'm glad to be here with you, but I'm glad you're here with me because we're all at my place today.
Our first mobile unit.
Yes, we are geeks on the move.
I thought we were geeks on location.
Did you see what I did there? Because, okay.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for joining me. Thanks for coming away all the way over.
And we're in this cool studio of yours with all sorts of...
Surrounded by all these wonderful toys.
Yeah, toys and sculptures and paint and...
Mess in general, kind of like
awesome.
Worky mess.
I like the giant bust of Ho Chi Minh. That's my favorite.
And he looks all serious in his conical hat.
And it says uncle / teacher on the side
of it. Uncle teacher, fuck you, G.I., you die. And Ho Chi Minh on the other side. But that's the new, it's a Frank Kozik piece that's going to, I think they're releasing it at Comic-Con. San Diego Comic-Con this year. And it's been taking a long time, but it's going to be excellent. That's going to be flocked in red. I think they're doing...
Which, the bust is going to be flocked in red?
Yeah, so the bust, the hat, the gun are all flocked in like commie red and then like a camo green.
Is commie versions. Red actually a color?
like a Pantone swatch? Commie red.
It's a Crayola color.
For those of us, our listeners, who aren't familiar with your work, could you go over some of the things that they may have seen that you had a hand in?
Right. Let's see. It started a long time ago. I did primarily character design for television, for puppets. Let me see. If we go back into the 90s, I had two partners, Dan Clark, Don Asher. We had a company called Wandering Monkey Entertainment in the 90s. And we had a development deal with the Jim Henson Company in the 90s. And we developed a show called... We developed like one show a year, but the one that got picked up and we did 13 episodes of was Bratz of the Lost Nebula.
Did you actually work with Jim or is this...
Post. Because we got involved with the company about 96. And I think he died in 1990, so...
Now, I met Dave when I was working on a film, and you took me on a tour around the Henson lot. Now, when we were there, there was a head sticking out of a wall, I believe it was. It sort of looked Borg-like, vaguely Borg-like from...
The Shock Warrior.
Okay, what was it?
It was the Shock Warrior, because the show was called Bratz of the Lost Nebula, and the premise is that there were... they're like five orphan alien kids from different planetary...
Universe.
Yeah. Thank
Universe-i.
You. Well, there's an evil like empire taking over the universe called the Shock, and it's run by a evil guy named Hexter Vigar. And that sculpture in the corner, which I guess this is great for radio. Which see, is, a cool sculpture
for
in the corner.
For those of you listening, we will have photos of all the things we're talking about with handy dandy subtitles up on our website.
Oh, okay, good. Well, that was the initial development sculpt. For Hexter Vigar, who was the evil...
So sort of a vaguely lizard-like creature with gigantic yellow eyes and shoulder pads. Is he wearing armor? Is that armor?
Yeah, it's like armor and stuff. But the guy that ultimately got designed was by this guy. I don't know his whole name. His name's Chief, and he worked for the Henson Company. He did a great design where he was a little more fey and a little more fantastic and regal and, you know.
But he also looked like he was made out of metal, right? Is that the same guy I'm thinking of?
No. This is a different guy. So those are his robot warriors, the Shock.
Yeah.
Those are
the metal. The Shock Warriors was one of the ones that I saw.
Okay, right.
Maybe that's what I saw.
And the cool thing about the Shocks were, so this was a puppet CGI show. And so the puppets, the kid puppets were about 3 feet tall and they were rod operated. And so figure a Shock Warrior was supposed to be this giant robot. Those puppets were actually like about 9 feet tall when they were all
awesome.
Standing. They took five guys to operate. They had legs, bodies, arms. Wow. There were... three episodes where we actually had a full body Shock on set, like punching through a wall or something like that.
That's so slick.
It was amazing. It was amazing.
Now, and the kid was the puppet that I saw in Brian's office or right outside Brian's office.
That is Lavanna, Lavanna character.
And she was sort of vaguely fairy-like and about 3 feet tall with this purple eye makeup and these huge wings.
Yeah. And it was all kind of like based on this. Well, the designer of those characters was Nathan Cabrera, and it was basically this kind of we wanted this kind of anime thing mixed with this kind of punk street thing. And he did a great job of doing that, because each one, she was like the ethereal fairy-like character. Zadum was, you know, the reluctant hero type teenager. So each one had, you know, a role to play in the show. But anyways, we shot a whole 13 episode pickup for the Kids WB, and it aired in 1998. And was canceled after 3 episodes.
Oy.
I know. Ouch. And
Don's all like, where can I get this show?
Yeah, like, I want this on DVD. Now!
Well,
this sounds awesome.
Well, you know what? That's one of the things. It's in the works, where it's trying to be worked out now, where the Henson Company is trying to work out a way to do a DVD set of it. Because, and the thing was, is that you, so out here, nobody knows of the show. But when I go to work in Canada and Toronto, you say, oh, yeah, I worked in Bratz Lost Nebula. Bratz Lost Nebula. Everyone's so, because that show ran and ran and ran, had a rabid fanship, and the fact that they, you know, people were hungry for more episodes, and they never got
them. And nothing happened.
I don't want to encourage any viewing of pirated video, but there is a lot on YouTube.
Are some clips, because my partners, the Dan Clark Company, which was is the company that I work with my two partners. They have a bunch of clips on YouTube, and so you can see clips of Bratz on the Lost Nebula. And it's cool. It was a cool show. I mean, you know, hopefully we won't be talking about it in the past tense for very long.
So what about shows like Los Luchadores? I mean, I know you did some stuff for them. I don't know if
Let's keep going through
I don't know if I'm moving throughout outside of your time.
We're getting kind of in order, because right after Bratz, we had a deal with the Jim Henson Company for 3 years, and then we left and had some other things to pursue, and we did a film called The Item. And that was literally a film that we did where we took our own money. My partner Dan wrote and directed the film. I designed the character and the creature character, and it was kind of a movie based on a little bit of a dark comedy, taking the piss out of all those movies in the 90s where you had all these kind of slick gangster films, like everything from Reservoir Dogs on down. And it was kind of taking the piss out of that. And we were having some more fun with it, where when somebody gets shot, there's too much blood. The bullets the guns never run out of bullets. Everything's over the top, from you know, sound effects, everything sweetened to... everything arched, you know. So that went to Sundance Film Festival. Totally surprised us, because we took our own money, would shoot, make a little money, shoot, make a little money, shoot, shut it down for a few months, shoot. Then in 99, in 98, we put together a rough video, sent it off to Sundance just as kind of a drill, and got into dramatic competition. And we were the first digital film, because we shot all on DigiBeta, because we saw the digital revolution coming. Mm-hmm. And so it was the first digital film, had it transferred to 35 for a blow up. And then that was the first digitally shot film to ever be in dramatic competition at Sundance.
Very cool.
Nothing happened with that either. We ultimately got distribution, and it's available now if you go on Amazon.com.
Oh, really? So you eBay. Can buy it?
You can absolutely buy it. Nice going. He just knocked over
Peter
the Ho Chi Minh
Peter has now destroyed Ho Chi Minh.
Priceless original work of art.
Don't worry, Peter.
It's original.
He's missing a tooth. Let's excuse him. He's probably all high on goofballs.
Can I tell you? As I always say, my IQ has dropped about 10 points since...
It'll be fine.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. It's just the master.
Ooh, and a room.
That's cool.
Geek song, leaving a trail of destruction wherever we go.
Wrecking priceless masters wherever we can.
So tell me the truth, was the hat removable before he knocked it over?
Yeah, sure.
It's an extra selling point now.
Doesn't the look on his face, Ho Chi Minh's face, doesn't it look all squinched up like
Ho Chi Minh is not amused.
Yeah.
Thank God we're not recording at like the National Museum of Art.
Yeah, exactly.
600-year-old paintings.
I strike again.
I'll get something else for you to knock over later.
So could you make it even more priceless?
I got Damien Hirst's diamond skull over there. Let me.
So you can also, by the way, you can see the trailer of The Item online, several places, I believe.
Yeah, it's on YouTube and it's on my blog.
Right.
It's on my Dave Presser Sculpting Stuff blog.
Your website is amazing.
Oh, I'm glad you like it.
It's so cool. I mean, it's all Flash-based and just incredibly easy to navigate and just funky stuff.
I'm glad you like it.
Did you design it?
No, I worked with a guy named Ronnie Piravino, and he did a great job because he's gotten in, I guess from what he tells me, and I might be misquoting him, but he really has gotten into doing a lot of artist websites lately, and he does a great job, so he has a feel for it. And like the blimp flying across was one of his ideas, and like he added the little smoke puffs. And but I wanted some. I had a crunky old website that I made, and I met him and we were talking, and he said, you know, you need something better. So we struck a deal and we came up with the website, but we worked on it for like, it was a few months, but it was great. It was great.
Now, when you're doing sort of concept art, and especially with a film like The Item, how do you go about it? Do you start on canvas, or do you specifically start sculpting right away?
Well, what I'll do is a lot of times for like the creature and the item, I have a little mini, there's a mini maquette over there of what eventually turned into the full-size puppet, which I'll bring out.
Can you see it, Don?
Which one?
It's the one up on the shelf that looks like a weird worm bouncing on a stick.
Yeah,
on that far shelf.
Peter's going to destroy it now.
Okay, Peter's going to knock it over. It's the only one, so knock it over good. Yeah, it's not attached to the... Yeah, grab it by the stick. There we go.
We'll get a photo of it later.
Old one tooth is doing good.
We can describe it.
He's doing good.
Oh, cool.
So that was like the 1/8 scale of the creature puppet. You can bring it out and put it on the table right here.
It looks sort of like a satanic sperm.
Right. it has a everyone says it has a very phallic quality to it.
There's a sort of penile look to it.
So what it was is always when I'm doing something in 3D is at a certain point, stop sketching, it's time to start sculpting, because I sometimes I'm able to sculpt things that I can't draw. And just realize them, especially if you're making a puppet or an animated character. And a lot of times when we started to get into, like, with working with the Henson Company in different places, we always were turned on by puppets. And so a lot of times I would draw stuff that looked very flat, and we'd do a presentation, and people would say, it's a good character, but I don't see him in 3D. Mm-hmm. So I quickly became a sculptor, because I would sculpt maquettes, like the ones you see over there on the shelf, to bring to the production meeting and say, here's what it would look like as a puppet. And then it was like the lights would go on, everyone would get it. Yeah.
So is that a process of discovery then? I mean, if you cannot draw it and you suddenly, is it when you're sculpting, you suddenly come on these ideas?
I think sometimes it is. For some stuff, it definitely is. Like, especially if ultimately it's going to be a puppet or something physical, there might be, like, let's say in the drawing, there's just something not right about the mouth or the eyes. Mm-hmm. And then when you sculpt it and see it in 3D, some stuff works itself out suddenly. And it's like, wait, let me change that. And I'll just actually like get in there and tweak the clay with my fingers. And now it all of a sudden works, you know?
And at that point, do you need to, or do you just leave it alone? Do you have to work out how that creature is going to be manipulated when you design?
Yeah.
Or do you just say, you figure it out later?
Well, you know what? It's a combo. You're right. That's a good question, because you always want to come up with a cool design first, and then let's figure out how it's going to work.
Right.
But there are certain elements where, like, you're not going to have a piece floating above its head with no support. You know what I mean? Or a piece of its body that you know, okay, so here's a hand and it's fully articulated and it, you know. There's some stuff where you realize you have limitations. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, come up with a cool design, figure out how it's going to be animated or how it's going to be made into a puppet second. Mm-hmm. Because you always back into that.
Is that how a lot of the animatronic discoveries are made? Purely because they're trying to fit their mechanics, I guess, within a design?
Well, you know what? I'm not sure, because, like, every time I sculpted, like, I sculpted some of the characters for Bratz of the Lost Nebula, and I worked in special effects for a couple of years. And so what I would do is they would give us, we would have the design blown up to 100% of exactly what it was going to look like. Mm-hmm. And so the mechanical guys were working right over there with the same blow up, with the same measurements. And so while you're sculpting, you know, they could always check something. They could always say, you know what, the jaw actually has a pointy spot here that's coming out, and you know,
you cover it up.
Yeah, you could figure it out. But a lot of times it was like you'd be kind of working on the same page, because when you're sculpting for effects, you have to, it's not as freewheeling like when I'm making my own characters. You have to keep the measurements correct, you know.
Okay, well then basically this is kind of riffing off of the design process. I'm wondering, since you're made puppets and toys, what type of stories then lend itself to this type of work? Or is it just another medium to tell any type of story? Like, do you use puppets to achieve something that you feel like only puppetry and toys and set creations can achieve? Or are you just replacing out, you know, live action with puppets?
Well, you know, there's always that rule that we knew for a long time, and I forgot who we heard it from, but they said, never do something with puppets that you can do with people. In other words, if you're going to have puppets, make them do something that you can't do. You know, if you're going to do you know, something where you have, you know, just a scene with two puppets talking. You know, they're better.
Outlandish.
Yeah, there better be something like outlandish. Why have people watch puppets?
Although then there's, you know, what was it, Team Fortress America or whatever, which uses puppetry as the joke of. I mean, you could have shot that whole movie with live action actors.
Yeah.
Puppetry is used as the absurdity of it.
Yeah. No, I saw, like, see, the thing was, though, is that I got, like, from Team America. That's what we're talking about, right?
Yes. Team America.
I got from the whole Team America thing that those guys don't, they're not fans of puppetry. They have contempt for it because they really do, because all through that movie, and I know the Kyoto brothers, I worked with them a lot, the guys who did the puppets and the major set pieces for that. I could see that they weren't having the patience to work the puppets. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to have like a puppet and you're trying to create an illusion and it's not working out, so you stop suspending disbelief. But it's another thing just to like smack a puppet into a wall knowing it's a puppet, or the sex scene where they're just clashing into each other. It's like, all right, we get it. It's like, you know, they're puppets. Or when they have the motorcycle and they knock it over with the camera.
Right.
You're taking it, you know, it's like you're taking the piss out of puppets. Mm-hmm. Do you like them or do you hate them? Because I got a feeling they don't like them. They didn't like working with them. They weren't having fun with it. And even though I thought, like, I'm looking at these incredible miniature sets and stuff, and I'm like, that's cool, you know?
Well, I just felt like they were just trying to be generally offensive every step that they could.
Well, one thing is, I don't think there's a popular embracing of the puppet medium in the United States, but I think there is overseas. Like, I worked with the International Puppet Festival in New York City once upon a time. And at that point...
Really?
I had no...
I didn't know that.
I had nothing... Well, it was just a production
thing. We're discovering new things about you.
Yes. It's a whole new world. It's back when I worked with the public. Resume. Plug right there. But the point was, the American stuff that was there always kind of lent itself to raunchy humor if it was adult, right? Mm-hmm. Most of it, though, was for children. But the stuff that was coming over from Europe and Asia, or from there were a lot of Asian American stuff that year, were really in depth. Like,
right.
And actually were telling stories that I didn't think were necessary to be told through puppetry. But using the puppets kind of made you step back to a degree and appreciate a different aspect of the story than you would have with actors.
So, I
have
to wonder if that has anything to do with kabuki theater. You know, with
there was a very strong, yeah.
You know, did you ever work with Bunraku or any of those type of puppets?
No, because I can't say that I had a lot of puppet experience before my partner Dan Clark moved out here. It was like 1991, and initially I was an actor. I was just an actor. I did a lot of improv and stuff, and then he was into writing and puppets because he had seen the stuff in Chicago where these guys were doing these weird basement, you know, theater things with puppets. And he was like, let's do a thing. The first thing we did was called Gack and Flem's Hollywood. And we got two puppets made on a shoestring budget. And we would go interview celebrities. And it
That's
was like...
hysterical.
Now, you think about it. Now, it's like, yeah, you got the dog.
Triumph and the insult dog.
But 91, we were taking this tape around. And everyone's going, well, that's weird. But no one's going to watch that. We were really
–
yeah, no, exactly. A lot of people are going, that's really cool and it's weird to watch, but I don't think there's an audience for that.
You're like trend-setting 2 years too early consistently.
Exactly.
that's because Hollywood works this way. Most people want to produce something that's already working. So
yes.
They saw your thing and said, well, there's nothing like that now not making money, so why would we do this?
Precedent is king.
So somebody who either is out of their minds, not paying attention, or generally brilliant, then decides to do something for the first time and makes the money, and everyone else then jumps on it.
Right. No, exactly, exactly.
So what came for you right after the item?
After the item, the next thing we were thinking of, that we're inkling, because we always started playing with something like an idea or something as we were like finishing something else, was the idea of, we had noticed like the vinyl, because this was in 99, so we had been watching like the vinyl kind of character revolution with guys like, you know, Murakami and stuff like that. And
Murakami stuff is amazing.
Oh, amazing. And I saw it and was just like, wow, you know. And so we
kind
of,
all the stuff you see at like Giant Robot.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was
Monkey
Giant
King.
Right.
Monkey King, all that stuff. And so what we were looking at is, there were two things. My partner Dan, who's very hip to the kids industry, kind of was like, you know what there isn't? You know what doesn't exist? Was an action-adventure show for preschoolers. Because either it was an older show that had a lot of Jeopardy, too much Jeopardy for preschoolers, or it was a baby show that was just too, you know, babies. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so what's in the middle? And so what we did was, we came up with an idea where I took the designs of kind of what was happening in the cool, hip hop, cute Japanese, made a bunch of characters, and then Dan came up with the concept of technology literacy, where we're teaching about machines and cause and effect, and we came up with the Save-Ems, and that's a show that's on right now. Cool. And the Save-Ems was produced by Discovery Kids, and we did two seasons of it. A third season's kind of up in the air right now. And
where can people see it?
Discovery Kids and the Learning Channel on Ready, Set, Learn in America. Mm. And it's funny. It's like soccer. It's like, it does really well in France and England and Italy and in America. Again, nobody knows about it.
That's funny.
The Save-Ems in Canada, it's doing great. It's on Prime networks all over the country except America.
Do you have a theory as to why that is? It seems to be a pattern.
You know, I have my opinions about I don't think Discovery Kids does enough promotion. I never got the feeling that they were sharky about promoting and coming up with a super hit. Mm-hmm. Well, my opinion,
now,
you know.
What, now, is this the digital puppets?
This actually is just pure CGI animation, because we actually first thought of it as, what if we had a puppet show? And then we realized we wanted the kind of action and we wanted the kind of adventure possibilities that just was going to be a nightmare to shoot as puppets.
Now, but did I see footage somewhere of point tracking,
yes,
hand puppets, and is that still done that way?
That is. I think you saw a clip of something. We did a test. We did a pilot for Cartoon Network in 2005. It was called Laugh Pad, another preschool show. Mm-hmm. And what we were trying to do was we got offered this opportunity, and then we went to the Henson Company because we knew they had the digital puppetry system, and that's the way we wanted to do it, because it was going to be these cool little CGI characters interacting with a human host.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is, with their digital puppetry system, you can have a puppeteer with the rigged into the computer doing the voice live. You can have then the actual
doing the voice live?
Doing the voice and the
That's
puppeteering
awesome.
Live. Yeah. And you can actually have the actress then standing off on green screen doing the scene in real time with the character.
Mm-hmm.
So there's chance for improv, there's a chance for spontaneous reaction, there's a chance to actually, like, then as opposed to animation where you're going to get your dailies, then make notes about it in the rough cut and then tweak things. It's very spontaneous, and you can do several different takes right in a row, and then you still have the opportunity in post to tweak things a little bit if you want.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Did that lead you to Los Luchadores or no?
Los Luchadores actually came before that. That was right around the time when we were developing the Save-Ems. And Los Luchadores was just, again, my partner Dan was really looking at, we were looking at a lot of those masked Mexican wrestling. No, masked Mexican wrestling movies.
Masked.
Mexican and resin movies.
Say that five times.
Say it. So we were watching a lot of that stuff. And again, it was the idea of, it's just kind of that fun thing. When you think of the old Batman series from the 60s and you think of that campy TV that kids fall in love with hot rods and weird villains and offbeat superheroes. And so we had the Luchadores, which was the main guy and his two sidekicks. And I'm forgetting every character's name right now. But and then
now that was on Cartoon
Fox
Network?
Kids.
Fox Kids.
It was on Fox Kids. And it actually, they did two seasons of that. And the greatest part of it was is he came with this character that was the Whelp, and it was a tiny Chihuahua with a weird mechanical kind of Terminator eye, and that was the evil villain. That was the evil villain of the whole show. And
now, did you design the art for the whole show?
Actually, Nathan Cabrera, again, I worked with him a lot. He designed this show, and it was one of those things where it was a good symbiotic relationship of, he was very good with the hot rods and the humans and the hardcore characters, and then I was kind of better with the whimsical elements. Mm-hmm. But I think the best example, one collaboration, is we got the breakdown as we were developing the show, and all it said was, it said the Whelp just needs some hip way to get around. And so we had designed like a Lincoln Continental where he had these skull warriors on Vespa scooters and stuff like that. But then the idea came one night when Nate and I were working at 3 a.m. We thought, what if he had a giant robot suit? And not only is it a robot suit, it's a pimp bot suit. It has spats and it has jewelry and it has like, he has a walking stick. And so we were laughing and we went nuts, did all these sketches. And the next day we're like, okay, this is far out, but we think you're going to like it. They dug it. And so the Whelp had a giant, well, they call it his robo suit, but
it's a pimp bot.
It was a pimp bot suit for sure. And of course Conan has a pimp bot, but I don't know. It'd be a nose to nose race to see who came with the, yeah. But basically so he had the robo mech suit, and that show was just fun because it was werewolves and mudmen and tiki monsters and
cool. So what are you designing now?
Right now, I've been doing a lot of vinyl toy work.
Okay.
And
are we going to see them at Comic-Con this year?
Yeah. There's a bunch of stuff. There's Nathan Gervasius, who's a designer. He did the Scary Girl series. Okay. I just did a Monkey King figure for him and
is
Monkey
that,
King toys.
Is that Rabbit or R-A-B-B-B-I-T?
No, that's Ron English. The Ron English Three-Eyed Rabbit. Ron English, he's an artist out of New Jersey. But the Monkey King...
We will have pictures of these on geekson.com.
Here, this is the sculpted head.
This is fascinating. I'm looking at the monkey head right now. We have a picture on our website. It looks suspiciously to me like a cross between a monkey and Whitley Strieber's Alien. You're going to wake up paralyzed in the middle of the night, and this monkey is going to come in and insert things into you.
He does have that feeling, doesn't he?
It's very Whitley Strieber. That's very funny.
Well, I think with the rest of his, when you see him with the rest of his body, he has a very heroic pose. He's on the figure will be on a cloud, a removable cloud base with a staff. I think the hands are going to be in a soft pose of rubber.
So it's straight out Monkey King.
It's straight out Monkey King. And it was weird because just after I finished his character, Lisa and I went to London and we went to see the Monkey King Opera in Manchester, which was done by the Gorillaz guys. It was Damien Albarn did the music, and then Jamie Hewlett, the designer, did...
They're one of my favorite bands.
Oh, my God. You should have seen this thing. Wait, I got to show you the program.
Pass this around. This program was a graphic novel. Here, I'll trade you the head.
Well, Gorillaz is kind of a graphic novel band. I mean, they create.
Yeah.
I don't know if they perform live shows, but all of their videos are animated and animated in a very Japanime sort of way.
Yeah, they did a live. They did a lot of live shows, and I think they did a similar thing with this, where a screen would come down. They would have amazing animation, like running us into a scene, and it was completely like, you know, Jamie Hewlett design, and then all of a sudden, like, the Monkey King would focus in on the character, the lights would do a crossfade, and now we're in, you know, our real character on stage. And then the lights go on, and we're in a world that looks just as lush as the animation you were just watching.
That's slick. Where was this, in the West End?
It was in Manchester. At they were having a festival, and that was its opening week. And it's going to be in Paris in September. It was the only thing that I know.
There are all these live shows that I want to see right now. Wow. I mean, this is one of them. The Dinosaurs Alive exhibit.
I want to see that.
Is
so
my
bad.
New utter fascination.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We have to find a link to this.
Their modelers and
amazing
animatronic is incredible. So,
as far as I'm always curious about this with toy design, which I don't know, it's almost. Toy seems that it's almost just sculpture design. Toy sculpture.
Yeah.
Do you start? Is there a story you're telling, or do you just sit down and just start? You know, just creature designs start popping out, and you turn them into toys. How, you know, what's the reason you create toys, and then where does it come from?
Well, let's see. I always felt I was a better sculptor than I was a painter. It's like I like my paintings, but. It takes me twice as long to like really get the effect I want. Whereas sculpting, I always feel it comes very naturally, and I can see it and it can work out. So a lot of those toys up there were other artists who were working for other companies. So I was approached early on to sculpt them, and each one of those artists I really like. Mm-hmm. And there have been some other artists who have approached me who I don't like.
Are you selective about that?
Yeah. Because if I don't like a toy, I can't get into it. Or if there's no opportunity for me to throw a little bit of my skills into it, mm-hmm. you know, like I was just talking about Nathan Gervais' Monkey King, and his designs were just so, it was just so ripe for doing, adding textures and making things pop and adding 3D elements. Of course, I wish I had the master here while I'm telling you this whole thing, but, so anything where I can take it to the next level somehow.
What was the story they told with the Monkey King? Was it the Chinese historical?
Yeah. And this one was based on, I guess he did an interstitial for Japanese or Chinese MTV, mm-hmm. where it's the Monkey King and
cool.
he's sitting.
Tripitaka and Pigsy and all of the.
Everybody's there.
That's awesome.
And all those costumes looked exactly like that on the stage.
Really?
Yeah. No, it's incredible. But yeah, so he took the design was taken directly from the animation he did for the MTV interstitial.
Okay.
And actually, the Monkey King's have a poster at San Diego Comic Con available, a print. I think it's a 50 limited edition print of the Monkey King fighting the monster whose name I don't know. But so when I'm doing somebody else's work, I really have to like it. And me personally, it's like if you look at a lot of the stuff, I like robots, I like monsters, mm-hmm. Here, let me grab some of this stuff. Actually, here, I'll go off mic and I'll grab some things that are kind of a good representation. Here's a robot pirate. I love robots.
Oh, did you design this robot pirate?
Yeah.
Where have I seen that?
Yes, where have I seen that?
I've been
that?
Trying to figure that out since I put late eyes on that.
He's been out since 2004. So wait, Robot Gangster Mouse. Here's...
Okay, so we have a robot pirate who's sort of like a half an egg with a wonderful sort of...
That one's broken just because he got shipped out. He broke, and so that's why he's back in my shop for repairs. This is Monster and Robot.
He only has a single eye and yet has an eye patch. Can he see?
I think that's the whole thing. It's like kind of a can he see? I don't know.
Then we have Robot Gangster Mouse, who has a gun just sticking out of the center of he's a
robot gangster mouse.
Yeah, but his whole head is made out of metal, and his ears are like these just little knobs on the outside. But the thing that makes him so striking is he's wearing a suit, and there's this hole in the middle of the suit with this big giant gun sticking out. You know,
right, I think
phallically.
All these guys are in my website too. I think I have Monster and Robot, but I love robots. I love irony. I love absurdity, and so it's like a lot of my like robot and monster. These two being friends is kind of absurd.
So, do you come up with that concept before you sculpt, or you just start sketching shapes and see where? How does it get developed?
Yeah, no, exactly. I'll just start sketching, and I'll come up with something that makes me laugh. Usually it has to be something that makes me laugh or something that's cool. The shape goes, the joke goes, you know. Wow. And so right now, though, there's a Monkey King is the place, and they're going to be producing my angry clobber monkey character, and he's going to be on display at Comic-Con.
Wait, well, yeah,
say that again.
Angry clobber monkey. He's on my website, so
we'll go look at
him. Do a nice squid and angry clobber monkey throws.
And some of these that are also on your website now will be at Comic-Con in addition to some new ones, or only the new ones will be at Comic-Con?
You know, some of these guys will be available because, for instance, Monster Robot, there's a gas-powered dragon robot that I have who's a big rusty
That's
dragon.
Cool.
Yeah, he turned out great. I have to pat my own back. I love him.
Gas-powered dragon.
Gas-powered dragon. And so a lot of the stuff I believe, and let me add the fact that they're handmade, signed limited edition. So I actually...
That brings up a question.
Yes.
Okay. So one of the hallmarks of the geek is collection.
Yeah.
All right. And specifically what you're creating here is like geek candy. So do you in any
geek
way...
Geek crack. Let's be upfront. Yeah.
Do you make these things specifically limited edition, or is it just because you're manufacturing that you have to because you're just one guy and you can't make them all?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's just me, and as you can see, they have a lot of little parts to cast, and sometimes it's like after building 20 of them, I can't take it anymore. Yeah.
So can you walk us a little bit through the production pipeline of one of these? I mean,
sure.
To me, it looks like it's magic that it's just here in front of me. So how's this done?
Well, the great thing is I just did the molds for I'm going to have an exclusive limited edition character at San Diego Comic-Con this year called Stupid Little Robot Buddy. And I'm going to do about 40 of these guys. Again, how many ever I can stand to make in the limited amount of time. And so what he is he's a little stupid robot. And so I'll show you.
A la.
So this is the...
Oh, so can we put pictures up of the pieces of this?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, awesome.
And I took some pictures of them before. So, for instance, you pass this guy around. He came apart during the... Okay, so this is the sculpt.
You sure you want to hand that to Peter?
Yeah. I'll hold it for him.
We hey, one, two.
By. I can look
Be
at
careful.
It
let I can look at it, you know. Can I taste
he's
it?
Got, it's just... he's got wheels at the bottom.
Right, he has no arms.
That's it?
Yeah. He just wheels at the bottom.
So he's sort of an upside-down trash can with a robotic capability.
It's Buckatron 2000.
Yeah. Buckatron 2000.
That's funny.
He's very incapable. Here, I'll show you the...
He's like R2-D2 light.
I should have thought of like any more of these materials out so wait.
He's like R2-D2's redneck cousin.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's much.
Okay, so these are the two promo posters that are going to be at Comic-Con.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's Stupid Robot Buddy.
We have to get a photo of these.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
So he's
that's
just
awesome.
That's Angry Clobber Monkey.
That is an awesome
Oh, that's Angry Clobber
posters?
You know what?
You should totally produce
sell posters.
Maybe that's what I should do. Maybe I should sell them on my website.
You should totally sell the posters.
Oh, definitely. I just made them the other day, so I'm like in my own little bubble here.
Yeah, this looks like one of those old-fashioned wrestling posters.
It's kind of a carnival look to it.
This looks like one of the ones that you would see at a circus.
Right. That was the whole idea.
Yeah, you could totally. This is an awesome.
All right, good. Well, I'll give you guys a JPEG, and we'll do a that if you put it up on your site, and then people can come to mind.
The angry clobber monkey has so very angry.
I haven't.
What was the question?
I asked if he'd ever done designs for video games.
I haven't, but there's a couple characters people have seen of mine or in the world where they were like they said the exact same things.
I would love to.
Don works in the video game industry and is designing.
Oh, okay.
So Don is salivating.
Yeah, maybe we have to talk.
He's looking at Dave hungrily.
Come talk to my precious.
Oh no, definitely have some stuff to talk about.
Okay, so now if have you ever worked with anybody? Oh, I'm sorry.
Before we go there. So as you saw, so this is just clay. I mean, this is a sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
I spray him with a little Krylon, like crystal clear, just as a barrier coat. I built a little wall out of foam core. I put them in a little
foam core chamber.
A little foam core chamber with some clay around the bottom that I punch some holes into and make some keys. Now he's in his little foam core chamber and I pour silicone into it.
Okay.
Basically, I have to go to a shop and you have to do this process called degassing so there's no air bubbles because you can't have any bubbles interfering with the character. Cures in about 10 hours. Okay, so now I have this first part. I remove it. I put a little Vaseline on there. Now I pour the second part. And so I turn the chamber upside down, tear the bottom off, build up some more walls. And now you can see now we have
a mold,
a two-part mold. So then what I do is I have this resin that I get from Silpak. It's two-part casting resin, and it's just a 50-50 mixture, very forgiving. You pour 50 in one cup, weigh it on a scale, 50 in the other cup, mix it together. It kicks off in like 7 minutes. It turns into a hard plastic, which is, for instance, this. These are legs from the Monkey King.
Having never worked with models of any kind, I have to say the feel of this cast, I've never felt anything quite like it.
That's
before.
So slick.
Now you don't have that cast survives how many pours?
You can pull like this. This is the leg mold that just happens to be sitting out, and I can get like out of that one little robot guy there. I could probably get 50 successful pours out of there, maybe 40.
Wow,
because it's smooth. But if it's very detailed, faceted, and stuff like that, yeah, it has a tendency it can tear apart.
Does which pour it is change the value of it? Like if it's the first one, it's the first robot out, the first...
You know what? No, it's true. It's actually true because I always save the first pour as the master, and I put it aside in case the mold were to get damaged or destroyed.
Oh, okay.
And then usually it can degenerate, but what'll happen is if it starts to degenerate, I'll stop making them, you know?
Okay.
Now, this guy's got some eyes in here that look like it would make it difficult to get the thing out.
Usually it's a matter of like when I get them out like that, you just have to kind of wiggle it and
it'll come right out.
Yeah, and kind of just like pull it a little bit. It's flexible, but it's also really strong. It doesn't tear very easily.
Wow, that's pretty wild.
But
so now you have this plastic piece. How much work, sanding, sculpting, or shaping do you have after that?
Well, then what I'll do is there'll probably be a seam where the mold joins together.
Sure.
X-Acto it off, sand it down a little bit. Then I use it's a Tamiya super fine primer, mm-hmm. And I use that stuff, prime it and paint it. And usually I try to like for this guy. Since I'm going to make such a small addition in such a short amount of time, I try to pick a color scheme that's going to be like, you know, like four colors.
Mm-hmm.
Spray a main color and then have like maybe three colors that I put on by hand. And then I literally sign it and number it, and it's done.
Bang one, bang two.
Wow. Exactly.
Now, from start to finish, let's go with a stupid little robot buddy here.
Right.
I feel really like I'm insulting you, calling you worthless.
Yeah, how about that
stupid robot, buddy? What is that thing?
Now, it's a small piece. I mean, it's maybe 2 inches tall.
Yeah.
If that. How many pieces make it up? How many pieces make it up?
I'm going to basically, this will be one pour. I'm just going to pour enough material in there.
Okay.
And then what I do is I literally like sit there and turn the mold until it kicks off so there's no air bubbles.
Mm, okay.
So, and then pop it out as one piece.
Wait. When you say you turn the mold so it kicks off, what does that mean?
All right. So, in other words, kicking off is just the shop term for when something hardens. It's like when I work in special effects, it's like, yeah, that stuff kicked off really quick. Okay. Which just meant it hardened really fast.
Okay.
Now, from start to finish, how long would that very small piece we're discussing take you to make?
Let's see. Just from pouring it in?
No, from like design to completion of the project.
If I only had him to do, let's do that.
Let's say that one.
Because it's always involved with like with everything else I have to do. Mm-hmm. I would bet I could like come up with the design, sculpt them in a day, then probably do the molding in another day.
Okay.
Like in a two-part mold, you have to wait 10 hours for this part to kick off or harden. And and then do the other part. So that actually adds an extra. But now that it's ready, I could go downstairs in my garage where I do all the messy plastic work. And actually, I'm going to make like about 5 of these tonight just to see, get a feel for, you know, what are the problems. Because that's the other thing. Every mold and every character has its own quirk, so you have to kind of try a couple out, you know.
Do you ever just make action figures for your kids just because?
You know what?
Because that would be awesome.
Custom made action figures.
Not dad's toys again for Christmas. Damn it.
Well, you know what's funny? It's like
getting homemade toys sucked.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what? There's two things that we do. One is we always like do stuff where we sculpt together, sculpt little creatures with Super Sculpey. But the other thing we do is when I'm down there making moldings and castings, sometimes, like I said, they don't turn out. Something goes wrong. They want the rejects. So in right. their rooms, they each have a little, like on the shelves, like row of these rejects that they've collected.
The misfit toys.
Yeah, because sometimes if it, you know, I want to do some of the stuff with them where we can make characters and mold them and cast them and everything, but then it kind of feels like a busman's holiday. It's like, I'm taking the day off so I can make, mold, and cast some more toys with the kids.
Who wants a Bob in the box?
Nobody wants a Charlie in the box.
So when you're doing this, when you're working for, let's say, somebody else, have there ever been projects where you were not satisfied? You got in, you were like, oh, why did I say yes? You don't have to mention names.
Yeah. There are.
And more often has it been because you're not happy with the look of the final project, or just because of the complexity of the project turns out to be more than you expect?
I think sometimes the problems lie in what somebody's expectations are. In other words, what does somebody expect? Like they give you the drawings, and of course, certain people are really good draftsmen and they'll do very good drawings for turnarounds. And other people, you're pretty much gonna have to go with the piece of art that they gave
you. I'm guessing what the three-dimensionality of this is.
Exactly.
Figures.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if you know somebody's work, it's easy. But then also it gets down to the idea of like what kind of you know, what are their expectations? Because a lot of times it's feel. It's like a feel for the character. And sometimes I feel like I'm pretty good at this, so I can really, you know, I'm going to get you something that's relatively good. And when people start kind of noodling over things where I feel like, it's okay, really, this is nothing. Do not noodle over
Aaron
this point.
Aaron hates that.
Aaron does the bow tie have to be red?
Right. You know, we can paint it any color you want. Let's just get it done.
I'm a graphic designer, and I get clients.
You get, yeah.
Fixated over something. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, exactly.
You really, that's the thing you're looking at now? We've got to move on.
No, exactly. We have to move on, because if you want to get this done on scale, because, you know, when you get into that, yes, there's artistic stuff. And yes, I always want to deliver somebody the thing that they want, you know. But there's also that thing about when they're just making insecure choices, or they're not sure about things, so they kind of like, you know, they're withering over something that I'm like, don't worry about it.
But then there's also that problem, if you want to deliver to them the thing that they want, they have to actually want something. You know, a lot of times they don't know what they want. They're just, you know, trying to figure it out as they go along. And that
right.
can be probably, you
But
know,
that's just, usually a confidence. Well, I don't want to speak for your clients, but usually it's a confidence issue of, you know, not knowing what you want is really just not being able to make a decision.
Yeah, right.
A lot of times.
I can't remember what you called these vinyl figures, the kind of the rough drafts.
We call them vinyl figures.
Ah,
no.
Fascinating.
No, which ones? The maquettes. So like the production maquettes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, say the maquette is your first draft on something for
right.
a project for someone. Is there sort of an average number of drafts you have to go through? And if so, do you have to just rework the existing maquette, or do you have to come up with a whole new one?
I'll usually always, once you've built up a base that's mm-hmm. that's the right size and right, I'll always work off of that one, you know. Okay. But it's also, it's like what I was going to say, what you were saying is true too, is that when people don't know what they want, the great thing to do is to be able to go to them, I got something for you. Mm-hmm. Here's what I think you need to do, and you're going to like this.
So you co-opt more than you capitulate.
Yes. I mean, sometimes what I'll try to is I'll have an idea. It's like, if they're like, well, I think it should be I'll say, you know what? I got something. I think it's going to be cool. And usually I do. Sometimes I punt. But most of the time I do have an idea, you know. And a lot of times, it's insecurity or if they're approaching a process, because this process for a lot of artists who have only done graphic design, suddenly they're working with me, mm-hmm. a sculptor who's turning this thing, and then there's this whole manufacturing process. They're a little intimidated because they've never gone through this before.
Right.
So I try to be reassuring and saying, like, no problem. Give me notes, you know, because mm-hmm. I have worked with a few artists where it was fantastic because they had a lot of notes, but they were good. They made sense. They had to do with the actual character appealing to them and appealing to the sensibility of the art.
Mm-hmm. You understood the notes. You could make the changes, though, that you and the client were happy, and then you could move on, right?
Exactly.
One of the things I was noticing as I was looking around here is that you've got these skulls in the room. I mean, right. Live human skulls with teeth.
Well,
and
dead human skulls.
Well, okay, you're right, you're right. Real human skulls is what
I'm
going
to say. I ain't got nobody.
We have five skulls, too.
But they've got these, like, teeth, and it's really interesting to have them sitting right next to puppets.
Right.
And the next part of the thing that I was noticing is that normally when you look at puppets, or when you think of puppets, you think of them as, like, puppet shows and things for kids, you know, that are, like, you know, it's got a certain kind of concept to it, but yet there's this really kind of great fusion between puppets and the ghoulish and ghastly things that at the same time in here. Like you've got the zombie Mickey Mouse basically over here. It's not really
Mickey
Mouse,
Ratfink,
but it's a zombie mouse, which is so like kind of ghoulish. Well, you've got this puppet that is literally like, I don't know if it's a spleen or a stomach.
No, it's a stomach.
Stomach. Yeah, tummy. The little tummy. Stomach.
Yeah. And
tummy. You designed tummy, right?
Yeah.
Tummy is one of my favorite designs. He's a creepy stomach.
He's just a little stomach character.
And it basically looks like someone was like, you know, taking organs out of a body and one of the organs grew a smiley face and some
eyes like a pet.
And started bouncing around. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know. But yeah, it's really interesting to see that kind of combination of inspiration.
Like the juxtaposition of kind of like really whimsical and really macabre.
Absolutely.
Kind of, yeah.
And can you talk a little bit about, you know, where some of that comes from or the fun of that?
I think the thing about the skulls and the human body and the medical stuff was ever since I can remember when I was like 3 or 4, I was fascinated by skulls, skeletons, anything to do with like human body stuff. I was always fascinated by that. And I also love robots. And so I had robots, and then I had like, remember the Visible Man kit, the big like
I can still build that thing blindfolded.
Oh wait.
Right.
I put it together and took it apart a million times.
Is this the thing that would have like all the organs inside you could see through the I do vaguely remember this.
Yeah. I have a picture of when I was, I don't know how old I was really little, cuz the box is I'm with the box very excited at Christmas and you know it was as tall as I was. So but I think that's always been a part of it, and
so model kits were where you started off.
Model kits and just all that kind of, I always caught this fascination for this like dark imagery, but was also, you know, dark humor, whimsical, entertaining, yet gory, you know. I remember we used to walk to the train station, and I must have been 3 or 4, and there was a comic book magazine stand. Do you remember the stories of like the old EC comics in the 60s, where before the code came up, they used to have like pictures of monsters like ripping off women's heads, you know, with their breasts showing, like, you know, on a front of a comic
much
book.
More pulp. Yeah.
And
the code killed so much good stuff. Really sad.
But I remember seeing that. Like, I actually remember seeing that and being like, wow. And then I remember my mom going, stop looking at that. You know, and it wasn't that I was repulsed by it. I was repulsed, but drawn to it. It was
intrigued.
Yeah, I was intrigued, you know.
And that's
had a switch to heavy metal.
Right.
That was like a switch.
Exactly.
But that's exactly also the point, is like these things that oftentimes we don't think, you know, that kids would get, they really are drawn to. I mean, kids like to be scared. They like to see things that are creepy and fun.
Yeah.
You know, and yet we have this kind of Pollyanna image that kids are supposed to be running through the flowers and, you know.
Well, that's what fairy tales used to be.
Oh, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Incredibly gory.
You know, they were all dark.
Yeah.
Everybody died.
So if we have our geek listeners out there and they want to get into this, they want to do what you do. What's the primer in how to be an early fledgling artist and get to do what you do?
I think the best thing to do is, especially with the internet now, it's so cool because if you draw or you paint, you immediately have a forum, you know, and you also immediately have a forum to connect with other people, especially if you don't live, you know, in a major city. But the other thing too is like with sculpting, with painting, with drawing, right now you just do it because think about it. If you want to take pictures of it and put it on the net, it's there. It's your forum. If you want to do animations, it's there. And I would think as far as like sculpting and vinyl toys goes and stuff, just the main thing is whatever, you know, because I run into to people sometimes, young people, and they go like, well, I want to draw characters. And you look through their portfolio and it's all like kind of like, you know, attempts at,
character.
Pre-made characters?
Pre-renders?
Pre-renders, yeah. Pre-made characters are just kind of like, or you know, what they think they should be doing.
It's imitative?
It's imitative. And I think everyone learns. You learn from imitating and tracing and stuff like that. But then also just like, what's your own, you know.
What's your style?
Yeah, what's your style? What do you want to do?
I think that develops. You know, I remember, you know, as I think any artist does this, is where you start off writing music that you that you've heard, and drawing pictures that you've seen, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then you keep doing it, and you keep doing it, you keep doing it, and you realize that you've changed it, and then you start just leaving the old stuff, and that's when you find yourself.
Yeah.
But the only way to do that is just to get through, slog through that stuff. So you can't, you're not going to just open, crack the book right away.
Right.
And write the perfect, you know, the perfect music piece that's all you, or sculpt the first piece. You got to just kind of work through that bullshit, you know.
No, and it's like, don't get frustrated. I think that's it. Don't, because, I mean, I'm 43, and I've been doing this particular thing for, I'm going to say, like 14 years, seriously.
Wow.
But I was always, you know, I mean, my dad was a commercial artist when I was growing up, so I always was drawing and painting, but I just went through a big portion of my life where I kind of saw that as work and kind of like really wanted to enjoy it. So I didn't really touch it. There was a like good decade or so where I did not draw, paint, or sculpt anything. But once I got back into it, it was almost like it just felt like this is what I should have been doing, you know. So
wow.
The key also seems to, I mean, looking around your room, the key is to do stuff you enjoy.
Yeah.
You know?
And yeah.
If you're not loving what you're making, no one else will.
It, ding. That should be a t-shirt. It's true though. It's true. It's just like a lot of that stuff there, for, you know, there's shows we developed, and a lot of the best stuff was stuff that me and my partner sat around with legal pads, just sketching, making ourselves laugh. The best ideas, the best shows we came up with came out of that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. you know? Wow.
So what do we got to look forward to at Comic-Con?
Well, let's see. We got the Little Robot Buddy. Monkey King.
That's stupid, Little Robot
Stupid. Buddy. Sorry. Yeah, I know.
We like, linked some to those posters on our website.
Oh, yeah.
Those posters are gorgeous.
Yeah, if you guys dig them, you know, maybe you've given me an idea. Maybe I should just sell those.
Put you
those
really, up absolutely really should.
All right. I love the posters.
Yeah, Clobber Monkey, I think, awesome. Is going to be a big hit. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, then maybe the posters.
So but posters will be there.
The posters will be there. Monkey King is going to have a booth there. Monkey King Melrose is going to have a booth there. And I do a ton of retail work with them. So they carry a lot of my, almost all of my limited edition resin. They're producing.
So how will they find all these things at Comic-Con?
You know, the booth map. Usually when you walk in, don't you, you get that thing.
Yeah,
and
you get the map.
It'll be they're having a booth.
And what's the name of the company?
Monkey King.
Monkey King. So all these will be there.
MunkyKing.
And will you be there?
I will be there. I'm probably going to be there because Lisa has stuff there. I have stuff there. I don't.
We should get Lisa to promo on a different show.
You should. You should, because she'd love to do a show with you guys. So, but there's also another thing that's going to be, I want to mention, is there's a company called Pop Kling. You're familiar with these guys?
Uh-uh.
They take local artists, LA artists, and other artists from around the world, and do these vinyl applications, and you can put them on your wall. So in other words, you have a favorite artist, they print out a gorgeous piece, full color, and they come, so you can stick it on your wall. And
is it like Glee Clay?
It's vinyl. It's actually like...
It's like that big sports stuff.
It is, but cooler. Exactly.
It's like your favorite... Like, it's like the Falcons, you know, receiver pasted on your wall, but cooler.
But if that seemed too gay for you to have a giant football player on your wall, then you want something like a piece of pop art or something. But the great thing is these things are gorgeous. They stick to the wall. Then when you peel them off, they don't destroy the wall. I mean, it just, they peel down. But I have a piece coming out with Pop Kling.
Oh, very cool.
So well, Pop Kling is going to piece.
Angry Clobber Monkey on my wall.
Angry Clobber Monkey, cool. Yeah. But so it'll be, yeah, Monkey King, and then Stupid Little Robot Buddy will be there. A couple of prototypes I've done for other people, plus prototypes of the Angry Clobber Monkey, which should be released as a vinyl by next year.
So all the people who are listening to us now, they go down and see your stuff. You might be there at the booth.
I might be there.
They can come and meet you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They can buy some stuff off of your website.
Buy some stuff off my website, DavePresslerArt.com.
Great.
And then check out my blog. My blog is Dave Pressler Making Stuff. There's a link off the website. But it's actually... That almost gets updated more than the website because it's just me going zoom, zoom, yeah, and just like, you know, right, sending stuff off. It's supposed to be about sculpting and actually how I do my projects, which I started it that way, and then I would go off in these tangents. And so right now I'm way overdue for like another sculpting, serious sculpting lesson, you know. But I try to cover a project from beginning to end, like from here's the drawing, here's the wireframe, here's how I go about making it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Great. All right, we'll send people there. You have your company has a MySpace page.
Yes, the Dan Clark Company has a MySpace page.
Do you personally have a MySpace?
I do too. It's just okay. Dave Pressler, and I'm there on MySpace. Be my friend.
I'll be your friend.
I'll be your friend.
I only have
I'll be you guys' friends. We'll all be friends.
Do I have to make a MySpace page?
You don't have one?
You don't have one?
I have my name.
I don't either.
You have a dial phone, too, right? You have a phone.
You guys should actually. I like the little click, click, click.
You guys should get on Facebook. It's the cooler place to
actually, I started on Facebook, and everyone has said, you got to get on Facebook. It's much cooler. So
and now, yeah, everybody's on Facebook.
I know. What somebody explained to me, they said, well, MySpace is kind of for 11-year-olds and then the 40-year-olds who are pretending to be younger, trying to get the 11-year-olds to come over to their house. I'm like... Yeah, then it's over, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
And you're not 11, so that puts you...
Well, then what am I doing on there?
All right, well, we're going to give Peter some super glue, and he'll get started on the statue. And,
yes, excellent.
I'm going to be here all night.
So you're sorry, Peter.
I'm sorry.
Peter. I'll sculpt you a new tooth.
Hey, that's a great idea. I'll take it.
That's awesome. We're going to get Peter a grill. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you. Yeah, this is so much fun.
We'll come down.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to see you guys.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Casino.
Awesome, awesome. I love the toy shop / puppet shop thing that was going on there.
I love that he only made Peter glue a few things back together.
Yeah, that was really class act right there.
But you know what was kind of cool is, you know, he just made new ones from scratch. It was like
right there.
You know.
And he made Peter a new tooth, which I thought was so cool.
It was really nice of him to do.
I'm not sure if we actually got this since the computer crashed at one point, that you found that ROM.
He had a ROM the Space Knight on his wall, and I just had a complete geek freak out. It was really kind of embarrassing.
It was awesome.
I kind of blew up.
I've never even heard of ROM the Space Knight.
It's really kind of an obscure character from, like, he was popular before I was a kid, but...
Yeah, but the... Well, when I was a kid, it was on television all the time. The ads were on the television over and over and over, and it was an electronic doll.
I wonder if we can find those on YouTube or something.
ROM the Space Knight?
Yeah, ROM the Space. You can find it on eBay and all that stuff.
No, I mean the ads.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, on a personal level, we've been very lucky with the interviews we've gotten, and I've got to say, the one consistency I've discovered across all of our guests is that everyone with one foot in the geek world are just the nicest, most open and enthusiastic people about what they do.
Yep.
Peter's
going to have some quiet time.
Peter's a meanie.
We've had good interviews, and they've all been really great, and they like talking to us because
I think we
understand them.
Yeah, and Dave was absolutely no exception to that. Yeah. He hung out with us afterwards in his studio and chatted for a long time about all sorts of fun and fascinating stuff.
Yep. So go find him at Comic-Con and tell him that you... Listen to him on Geeks On.
Yep.
And
don't forget to go check out his website. We have links up on geekson.com.
Yep, exactly.
Cool. Well, I will see you guys at Comic-Con.
Woohoo!
Yay!
Yay!
See you soon.
And hopefully see some of you people who are listening to us.
The geek or the geekling? I'm thinking, like, I don't know, Southern Comfort, maybe?
No, rum based.
Okay.
Gotta be rum.
Okay.
Just so every time you have a sip, you can go, arr.
Thank you.